"Difficult to say without tests," said the metallurgist. "Look, I've got a dinner tonight and my daughter's wedding tomorrow. Can I run them through some tests on Monday and call you?"
"Monday will do fine," said Preston. "I'm taking a few days off, actually. I'll be at home. Can I give you my number in Kensington?"
Dr. Wynne Evans hurried upstairs, locked the discs in his safe for the night, bade goodbye to Preston, and hurried to his dinner. Preston drove back to London.
While he was driving, the listening station at Menworth Hill in Yorkshire picked up a single squirt from a clandestine transmitter. Menwith got it first, but Broady in Wales and Chicksands in Bedfordshire also got a trace and computed the cross-bearings. It was somewhere in the hills north of Sheffield. When the Sheffield police got there, the spot turned out to be a lay-by on a lonely road between Barnsley and Pontefract. There was no one there. Later that evening, one of the duty officers at GCHQ Cheltenham accepted a drink in the office of the duty director. "It's the same bugger," he said. "He's carborne, and he's got a good set. He only spent 5 seconds on the air, and it looks indecipherable. First the Derbyshire Peak District, now the Yorkshire Hills. It looks as if he's somewhere in the North Midlands."
"Keep after him," said the director. "We haven't had a sleeper transmitter go suddenly active in ages. I wonder what he's saying."
What Major Valeri Pietrovsky had been saying, although transmitted by his operator when he was long gone, was: "Courier 2 never showed. Inform soonest. Ray arrival. Substitute." The first bottle of Achtermar stood empty on the table, and the second was well broached. Marchenko was flushed, but he could be a two-bottle-a-day man when the mood took him, and he was still well in control. Karpov, although he seldom drank for pleasure, and even more rarely alone, had seasoned his stomach for years on the diplomatic circuit. He had a good head when he needed it. Apart from that, he had forced 1/2 pound of white butter down his throat before leaving Yasyenova, and though he had nearly gagged on it, the fat was lining his stomach and retarding the onset of the alcohol's effect.
"What have you been up to these days, Peter?"
he asked, using the diminutive address form.
Marchenko's eyes narrowed. "Why do you ask? Come on, Peter, we go back a long way. Remember when I saved your ass in Afghanistan 3 years back? You owe me a favour. What's going on?"
Marchenko remembered. He nodded solemnly. In 1984, he was heading a big GRU operation against the Muslim rebels up near the Khyber Pass. There was one particularly outstanding guerrilla leader who ran raids into Afghanistan, using as his bases the refugee camps inside Pakistan. Marchenko had rashly sent a snatch squad over the border to get him. They had run into bad trouble. The pro-Soviet Afghans had been unmasked by the Pathans and had died horribly. The single Russian accompanying them had been lucky to survive. The Pathans had handed him to the Pakistani authorities of the Northwest Frontier District, hoping for some arms in exchange. Marchenko had been out on a limb. He had appealed to Karpov, then heading the Illegals Directorate, and Karpov had endangered one of his best undercover Pakistani officers in Islamabad to get the Russian sprung and back over the border.
A big international incident then could have broken Marchenko, and he could have joined the long list of Soviet officers whose careers had crashed in that miserable country. "Yes, all right, I know I owe you, Zhenya, but don't ask what I've been on for the past few weeks. Special assignment, very close to the chest, know what I mean? No names, no pack drill."
He tapped the side of his nose with a sausage-like forefinger and nodded solemnly.
Karpov leaned forward and topped up the GRU general's glass from the third bottle. "Sure, I know. Sorry I asked," he said reassuringly. "Won't mention it again. Won't mention the operation again." Marchenko waved an admonitory finger. His eyes were bloodshot. He reminded Karpov of a wounded boar in a thicket, brain dimmed by alcohol instead of pain and blood loss, but still dangerous. "Not operation. No operation. Sorry, thing cancelled. Sworn to secrecy, all of us, very high up, far higher than you could imagine. Don't mention it again, okay?"
"Wouldn't dream of it," said Karpov, topping up the rummers again. He was taking advantage of Marchenko's drunkenness to fill the GRU man's glass fuller than his own, but he was still having to focus his gaze with an effort. 2 hours later, the last Achtermar was a third gone. Marchenko was slumped, chin on chest. Karpov raised his glass in another of the endless toasts. "Here's to oblivion."
"Oblivion?"
Marchenko shook his head in bewilderment.
"All right, UFC these sods under the table any time. Not oblivious."
"No," corrected Karpov. "Oblivion of the plan.
We just forget it, right?" "Aurora." "Right, forget it. Bloody good idea, though."
They drank. Karpov topped them up. "Sod them all," he proposed.
"Screw Philby and the academician."
Marchenko nodded in agreement, the brandy that had missed his mouth dripping off his jowls.
"Krylov, asshole, forget them all."
It was midnight when Karpov staggered to his car. He leaned against a tree, stuck 2 fingers down his throat, and threw up what he could into the snow, sucking in gulps of the freezing night air. It helped, but the drive to his dacha was murder. He made it with a scraped fender and 2 nasty scares. Lyudmila was still up, in a housecoat, and she put him to bed, terrified that he had actually driven out from Moscow in that condition. On the Saturday morning, John Preston drove down to Tunbridge to pick up his son, Tommy. As usual, when his dad collected him from school, the boy was a torrent of words, memories of the term just passed, projects for the term yet to come, plans for the holiday about to begin, praise for his best friends and their virtues, scorn for the infamies of those he disliked. The trunk and tuck box were in the boot, and the drive back to London was, for John Preston, bliss. He mentioned the several things he had planned for their 1 week together, and was happy they seemed to meet with approval. The lad's face only fell when he recalled he would be returned after a week to the smart, brittle, and pricelessly expensive Mayfair apartment where Julia lived with her gown manufacturer companion. The man was old enough to be his grandfather, and Preston suspected that any breakages in the flat would lead to a severe frost in the atmosphere. "Dad," said Tommy as they drove over Vauxhall Bridge, "why can't I come and stay with you all the time?" Preston sighed. It was not easy to explain the breakup of a marriage, or the cost of it, to a 12-year-old. "Because," he said carefully, "your mummy and Archie aren't actually married. If I insisted to mummy on a formal divorce, she could ask for and get an allowance from me called maintenance, which, incidentally, I couldn't afford, not on my salary. At least not enough to keep myself, you at school, and her. It just wouldn't go that far. And if I couldn't pay that allowance, the court might decide your best chances in life were with Mummy, so we wouldn't get to see each other even as often as we do." "I didn't know it came down to money," said the boy sadly. "In the end, most things come down to money. Sad, but true. Years ago, if I had been able to afford a better kind of life for all 3 of us, Mummy and I might not have broken up. I was just an army officer, and even when I quit the army to join the Home Office, the salary still wasn't enough." "Just what do you do in the Home Office?" asked the boy. He was dropping the subject of his parents' estrangement, the way the young will try to blank out something that hurts them. "Oh, a sort of minor civil servant," said Preston. "Gosh, that must be jolly dull." "Yes," Preston conceded. "I suppose it is, really." Yevgeny Karpov woke at noon with an imperial hangover that 6 aspirins were only just able to contain. After lunch he felt somewhat better and decided to go for a stroll. There was something at the back of his mind, a memory, a half-recollection, that he had heard the name Krylov somewhere in the not-too-distant past. It bothered him. One of the restricted list reference books he kept at the dacha gave him the details of Professor Krylov, Vladimir Ilyich, historian, professor at Moscow University, lifelong member of the party, member of the Academy of Sciences, member of the Supreme Soviet, etc., etc. All that he knew, but there was something else. He ploughed through the snow, his head bowed, deep in thought. The boys had gone off on their skis to take advantage of the last of the good powder snow before the coming thaw spoiled it all. Lyudmila Karpova trailed along behind her husband. She knew his mood and refrained from interrupting. The previous evening she had been surprised, but quite happy at the state he had been in. She knew he hardly ever drank, and never that heavily, which counted out a visit to his girlfriend. Perhaps he really had been with a colleague from the GRU, one of the so-called neighbours. Whatever, something had got on top of him, but it was not a partridge in the Arbat. Just after three, whatever he had been racking his brains for came to him. He stopped several yards ahead of her, said, "Damn, of course," and perked up at once. He took her arm, all smiles, and they walked back to the dacha. General Karpov knew he had some quiet research to do in his office the next morning, and that he would visit Professor Krylov in his Moscow apartment on the Monday evening. Chapter 16. The phone call on the Monday morning caught John Preston just as he was about to leave home with his son. "Mr. Preston, Duffet Wynne Evans here." For a moment the name meant nothing to him. Then he recalled his request of the Friday evening. "I've had a look at your little piece of metal. Very interesting. Can you come out here and have a chat with me?"
"Well, actually, I'm taking a few days off," said Preston. "Would the end of the week suit?"
There was a pause in the Aldermaston end.
"I think it might be better before, then, if you could spare the time." Could you give me the gist of it down the phone?
"Much better we talk about it face to face," said Dr. Wynne Evans. Preston thought for a moment. He was taking Tommy to the Windsor Safari Park for the day, but that was also in Berkshire.
"Could I come by this afternoon, say about 5?
He asked.
5 it is, said the scientist. Ask for me at the desk. I'll have you shown up.
Professor Krylov lived on the top floor of a block on Komsomolsky Prospekt, with commanding views of the Moskva River, and handy for the university on the southern side. General Karpov pressed the buzzer just after 6, and it was the academic himself who answered it. He surveyed his visitor without recognition. "Comrade Professor Krylov?"
"Yes?"
"My name is General Karpov. I wonder if we might have a word or two." He held out his personal pass. Professor Krylov studied it, taking in the rank and the fact his visitor was from the first chief directorate of the KGB. Then he handed it back and gestured Karpov to enter. He led the way to a well-furnished sitting room, took the guest's coat, and bade him be seated.
"To what do I owe the honour?"
he asked, when he had seated himself opposite Karpov. He was a man of distinction in his own right, not in any way awed by a general of the KGB. Karpov realized the professor was different. Erita Philby he could trick into revealing the existence of the chauffeur. Driver Grigoriev he could browbeat by his intimidating rank. Marchenko was an old colleague and a too heavy drinker. Krylov was high in the party, the Supreme Soviet, the Academy, and the elite of the state. He decided to waste no time, but to play his cards fast, and without mercy it was the only way.
"Professor Krylov, in the interests of the state, I wish you to tell me something. I wish you to tell me what you know about Plan Aurora."
Professor Krylov sat as if he'd been slapped. Then he flushed angrily.
"General Karpov, you exceed yourself," he snapped. "I do not know what you're talking about."
"I believe you do," said Karpov evenly, "and I believe you should tell me what this plan entails." In answer, Professor Krylov held out a peremptory hand.
"Your authority, please."
"My authority is my rank and my service," said Karpov.
"If you have no personal signed authority from the Comrade General Secretary, you have no authority at all," said Krylov icily. He rose and made for the telephone.
"Indeed, I think it's high time your line of questioning came to the attention of an authority far higher than yourself."
He picked up the receiver and prepared to dial.
"That might not be a very good idea," said Karpov.
"Did you know that one of your fellow consultants, retired colonel of the KGB Philby, has already gone missing?"
Krylov stopped dialing.
"What do you mean,
gone missing?" he asked. The first edge of hesitation had entered his hitherto completely assured bearing.
"Please sit down and hear me out," said Karpov. The academic did so.
Further into the apartment, a door opened and closed. In the second of its opening, a blare of Western jazz music could be heard, which muted when the door closed.
"I mean, gone missing," said Karpov. "Missing from his apartment. Driver dismissed. Wife no idea where he is, or when, if at all, he'll be back."
It was a gamble, and a damnably high one, but an air of worry entered the professor's gaze. Then he reasserted himself.
"There can be no question of my discussing affairs of state with your comrade general. I think I must ask you to leave."
"It's not quite that easy," said Karpov. "Tell me, Professor, you have a son, Leonid, do you not?"
The sudden switch in topic genuinely dumbfounded the professor.
"Yes," he conceded, "I do. So what?"
"So, let me explain," suggested Karpov. On the other side of Europe, John Preston and his son were driving out of the Windsor Safari Park at the close of a warm spring day.
"I've just got one call to make before we go home," said the father. "It's not far, and it shouldn't take long. Have you ever been to Aldermaston?"
The boy's eyes opened wide.
"The bomb factory?" he asked.
"It's not quite a bomb factory," Preston corrected. "It's a research establishment."
"Gosh, no. Are we going there? Will they let us in?"
"Well, they'll let me in. You'll have to sit in the car in the park, but it won't take long."
He turned north to cut into the M4 motorway. Your son returned 9 weeks ago from a visit to Canada, where he had acted as one of the interpreters to a trade delegation, said General Karpov quietly.
Krylov nodded.
"So?"
"While he was there, my own KR people noted that an attractive young person was spending a deal of time, too much time it was judged, trying to get into conversation with the members of our delegation, notably the younger members, secretaries, interpreters, and so forth. The person concerned was photographed and finally identified as an entrapment agent, American, not Canadian, and almost certainly employed by the CIA. As a result, that young agent was put under surveillance and was observed to set up a rendezvous with your son Leonid in a hotel room. To put not too fine a point on it, the pair had a brief but torrid affair." Professor Krylov's face was mottled with rage. He seemed to have trouble enunciating his words.
"How dare you! How dare you have the impertinence to come here and seek to subject me, a member of the Academy of Sciences, and the Supreme Soviet, to crude blackmail? The party shall hear of this. You know the rule. Only the party can discipline the party. You may be a general of the KGB, but you have overstepped your authority by 100 miles, General Karpov."
Yevgeny Karpov sat, as if humbled, staring at the table as the professor went on.
"So, my son screwed a foreign girl while in Canada. That the girl turned out to be an American was certainly something of which he was completely unaware. Indiscreet, perhaps, but no more. Was he recruited by this CIA girl?"
"No," admitted Karpov.
"Did he betray any state secrets?"
"No."
"Then you have nothing, Comrade General, but a brief youthful indiscretion. He'll be rebuked, but the rebuke for your counterintelligence people will be the greater. They should have warned him. As to the bedroom business, we are not so unworldly in the Soviet Union as you seem to think. Strong young men have been screwing girls since time began."
Karpov had opened his attaché case and produced a large photograph, one of a sheaf that lay inside the case, and placed it on the table. Professor Krylov stared at it, and his words died. The flush went out of his cheeks, draining away until his elderly face appeared grey in the lamplight. He shook his head several times.
"I'm sorry," said Karpov very gently.
"Truly sorry. The surveillance was on the American boy, not your son. It was not intended that it should come to this."
"Don't believe it," croaked the professor.
"I have sons of my own," murmured Karpov. "I believe I can understand, or try to understand, how you feel."
The academic sucked in his breath, rose, muttered, "Excuse me," and left the room. Karpov sighed and replaced the photograph in his case. From down the corridor he heard the blare of jazz as a door opened. The sudden ending of the music and voices, two voices raised in anger. One was the roar of the father, the other a higher-pitched voice, as of a young man. The altercation ended with the sound of a slap. Seconds later, Professor Kryloff re-entered the room. He seated himself, eyes dull, shoulders sloping. "What are you going to do?" he whispered.
Karpov sighed. "My duty is very clear. As you said, only the party may discipline the party. I should, by rights, hand over the report and the photographs to the Central Committee. You know the law. You know what they do to golden boys. It's 5 years without remission and strict regime. I'm afraid once in the camps, word gets around. After that, the young man becomes, how shall I put it, anybody's. A lad from a sheltered background would be hard put to survive that sort of thing. But, prompted the professor, but I can decide that there is a chance the CIA will seek to pursue the matter. I have that right. I can decide the Americans could become impatient and send their agent into the Soviet Union to resume contact with Leonid. I have the right to decide the entrapment of your son could possibly be turned into an operation to trap a CIA agent. While waiting, I would be able to keep the file in my personal safe. And the waiting could take a very long time. I have that authority. In operational matters, yes, I have that authority. And the price? I think you know that. What do you want to know about Plan Aurora? Just start from the beginning. Preston swung into the main gate at Aldermaston, found a slot in the visitor's car park, and got out. Sorry, Tommy, no further. Just wait for me here. I hope I won't be long. He crossed in the dusk to the swing doors and presented himself to the two men on the desk. They examined his ID card and rang Dr. Wynne Evans, who sanctioned the visit to his office. It was three floors up. He was shown in and gestured to a seat facing the desk. The scientist regarded him over his glasses. "May I ask where you got this little exhibit?" he inquired, pointing to the heavy, lead-like disc of metal which now sat in a sealed glass jar. It was taken off someone in Glasgow during the small hours of Thursday morning. What about the other two discs? Oh, they're just ordinary aluminium boil. Nothing strange about them. Just used to keep this one safe and sound. This is the one that interests me. Do you know what it is? Asked Preston. Dr. Wynne Evans seemed startled by the naivety of the question. Of course I know what it is, he said. It's my job to know what it is. It's a disc of pure polonium. Preston frowned. He had never heard of such a metal. Well, it all started in early January with two memoranda submitted by Philby to the General Secretary. In these papers, Philby maintained there existed within the British Labour Party a hard left wing that had grown so strong it was in a position to take over complete control of the party machine, more or less, when it wished. That corresponds with my own view.
And mine, murmured Karpov.
Philby went further. He claimed there was, within the hard left wing, a group, an inner kernel of dedicated Marxist-Leninists who had framed an intention to do just that, but not in the period before Britain's next general election, after it, in the very wake of a Labour electoral victory. In short, to await the victory at the polls of Mr. Neil Kinnock, and then to topple him from the party leadership. His replacement would be Britain's first Marxist-Leninist premier, who would institute a series of policies wholly in line with Soviet foreign and defence interests, most notably in the area of unilateral nuclear disarmament and the expulsion of all American forces.
Feasible, nodded General Karpov.
So, a committee of four of you was called together to advise how this electoral victory could best be achieved.
Professor Kryloff looked up, surprised.
Yes, there was Philby, General Marchenko, myself, and Dr. Rogoff.
The chess grandmaster.
And physicist, added Kryloff. What we came up with was Plan Aurora, which would have been an act of massive destabilization of the British electorate by pushing millions towards a mood of determined unilateralism.
You say, would have? Yes, the plan was principally Rogoff's idea. He supported it strongly. Marchenko went along with reservations. Philby, well, no one could tell what Philby was really thinking, just kept nodding and smiling, waiting to see which way the wind blew. That's Philby, agreed Karpov. And then you presented it? Yes, on the 12th of March. I opposed the plan. The General Secretary agreed with me. He denounced it roundly, ordered all notes and files destroyed, and swore all four of us never to mention the issue again under any circumstances. Tell me, why did you oppose it? It seemed to me reckless and dangerous. Apart from anything, it was in complete contravention of the Fourth Protocol. If that protocol is ever breached, God knows where the world will end up. The Fourth Protocol? Yes, to the International Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. You remember that, of course. One has to remember so much, said Karpov gently. Please remind me. I've never heard of polonium, said Preston. No, well, you probably wouldn't have, said Dr. Wynne Evans. I mean, you don't find it hanging about on your workbench. It's very rare. And what are its uses, Doctor? Well, it is occasionally, only very occasionally, mind, used in curative medicine. Was your man in Glasgow on his way to a medical conference or exhibition? No, said Preston firmly. He was in no way heading for a medical conference. Well, that would have accounted for a 10% possibility of what it was intended for, before you relieved him of his burden. Since he wasn't going to a medical conference, I'm afraid that leaves the 90% likelihood. Apart from these two functions, polonium has no known use on this planet. And the other use? Well, a disk of polonium this size will do nothing on its own, but in close juxtaposition with a disk of another metal called lithium, the two combine to form an initiator. A what? An initiator. And what, pray, the hell is that? On the 1st of July, 1968... said Professor Krylov. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed between the three then nuclear powers of the world, the USA, Great Britain, and the USSR. In the treaty, the three signatory nations pledged themselves not to impart the technology or the material capable of enabling the construction of a nuclear weapon to any nation not then in possession of such technology or material. Do you recall that? Yes, said Karpov. I remember that much. Well, the signing ceremonies in Washington, London, and Moscow were attended by huge and worldwide publicity. A complete absence of publicity surrounded the later signing of four secret protocols to that treaty. Each of the protocols foresaw the development of a possible future hazard, which was not then technically possible, but which, it was then estimated, might one day become technically possible. Over the years, the first three protocols passed into history, either because the hazard was established to be quite impossible, or because an antidote was discovered as fast as the threat became reality. But by the early 80s, the fourth protocol, the most secret of them all, had become a living nightmare. What exactly did the fourth protocol envisage? Asked Karpov. Professor Krylov sighed. We relied on Dr. Rogoff for this information. As you know, he is a nuclear physicist. That is his branch of science. The fourth protocol foresaw technological advances in the manufacture of nuclear bombs, mainly in the areas of miniaturization and simplification. This apparently is what has happened. In one area, the weapons have become infinitely more powerful, but more complex to construct and large in size. Another branch of the science has gone the other way. The basic atomic bomb, which it once took a huge bomber to drop on Japan in 1945, can now be made small enough to go in a suitcase, and simple enough to be assembled from a dozen prefabricated, milled and threaded components, like a child's construction kit. And that is what the fourth protocol banned. Professor Krylov shook his head. It went further. It forbade any of the signatory nations to introduce onto the territory of any nation a device in assembled or unassembled form by covert means for detonation in, say, a rented house or flat in the heart of a city. No 4-minute warning, mused Karpov. No radar detection of an incoming missile. No counter-strike. No identification of the perpetrator.
Just a megaton explosion from a basement bedsitter.
That's right, nodded the professor. That's why I called it a living nightmare.
The open societies of the West are more vulnerable, but we are none of us immune from smuggled artifacts. If the fourth protocol is ever breached, all those ranks of rockets and electronic countermeasures, indeed most of the arms-stroke-industrial complex, becomes irrelevant.
And that was what Plan Aurora had in mind.
Krylov nodded. He seemed to clam up.
But since, pursued Karpov, it was all stopped and prohibited, the whole plan has become what in the service we call archival.
Krylov seemed to grasp at the word. That's right, it's just archival now.
So tell me what it would have been, Karpov pressed him.
Well, Plan Aurora intended to infiltrate into Britain a top-class Soviet agent who would rent a provincial villa and become the executive officer of Aurora. To him, using a variety of couriers, would be smuggled the 10 or so component parts of a small atomic bomb of about 1.5 kiloton power.
So small? Hiroshima was 10 kilotons.
It was not intended to cause huge damage. That would have cancelled the general election. It was intended to create a supposed nuclear accident and panic the 10% floating vote into unilateralism and support at the polls of the only party pledged to unilateralism, the Labour Party.
I'm sorry, said Karpov. Please go on.
The device would have been detonated 6 days before polling day, said the professor. The place was vitally important. The one selected was the United States Air Force base at Bentwaters in Suffolk. Apparently F-5 strike planes are based there, and they carry small tactical nuclear devices for use against our mass tank divisions in the event of our invading Western Europe.
Karpov nodded. He knew Bentwaters, and the information was correct.
The executive officer, went on Professor Krylov, would have been ordered to take the assembled device by car to the very perimeter wire of the base in the small hours of the morning. The whole base, it seems, is in the heart of Rendlesham Forest. He would cause the explosion just before dawn. Because of the smallness of the device, damage would be limited to the air base itself, which would be vaporized, Rendlesham Forest, three hamlets, a village, the foreshore, and a bird sanctuary. The base being right next to the Suffolk coast, the cloud of radioactive dust thrown up would have drifted on the prevailing west wind out over the North Sea. By the time it reached the coast of Holland, 95% of it would have become inert or fallen into the sea. The intent was not to cause an ecological catastrophe, but fear, and a violent wave of hatred of America.
They might not have believed it, said Karpov. A lot of things could have gone wrong. The executive officer could have been caught alive.
Professor Krylov shook his head. Rogoff thought of all that. He worked it out like a chess game. The officer in question would have been told that after pressing the button he had 2 hours on the timer to drive as far as he could. In fact, the timer would be a sealed unit, set for instant detonation.
Poor Piotrowski, thought Karpov. And the credibility angle? He asked.
On the evening of the same day as the explosion, said Krylov, a man who was apparently a covert Soviet agent would have flown to Prague and given an international press conference. An Israeli nuclear physicist called Nachum Visser. It seems he works for us.
General Karpov kept a deadpan face. "You amaze me," he said. He knew the file of Dr. Visser. He had once had a son on whom he doted, and the youth had been a soldier in the Israeli army stationed in Beirut in 1982, when the Falangists devastated the Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. The young Lieutenant Visser had tried to intervene. He had been cut down by a bullet.
Carefully constructed evidence had been presented to the grieving father, already a committed opponent of the Likud party, that it had been an Israeli bullet that killed his son. In his bitterness and rage, Dr. Visser had swung a little further left and agreed to work for Russia. Anyway, Dr. Visser would have claimed to the world that he had collaborated for years with the Americans while on exchange visits in the development of ultra-small nuclear warheads. This, it seems, is true. He would have gone on to say that he had repeatedly warned the Americans that these ultra-small warheads were not stable enough to permit deployment.
But the Americans were impatient to deploy these new warheads so as to increase the range of their F-5s by being able to take on board extra fuel. It was calculated that these claims, appearing on the day following the explosion, the 5th before the polling date, would turn the wave of anti-Americanism in Britain into a gale that not even the Conservatives could hope to stem. Karpov nodded. Yes, I believe it would have done that. Anything more from the fertile brain of Dr. Rogoff? Much more, said Krylov glumly. He suggested the American reaction would be a histrionic and violent denial. Thus, on the 4th day before polling, the General Secretary would announce to the world that if the Americans intended to enter a period of insanity, that was their business. But he, for his part, had no alternative in the protection of the Soviet people but to put all our forces on red alert. That evening, one of our friends, very close to Mr. Kinnock, would have urged the Labour leader to fly to Moscow, see the General Secretary personally, and intervene for peace. Had there been any hesitation, our own ambassador would have invited him round to the embassy for friendly discussion of the crisis. With the cameras on him, it was doubtful he would have resisted. Well, he would have been issued a visa within minutes, and flown on Aeroflot the next morning at dawn. The General Secretary would have received him before the cameras of the world's press, and a few hours later they would have parted, both looking extremely grave. As no doubt he would have been given cause to look, suggested Karpov. Precisely. But while he was still airborne back to London in the evening, the General Secretary would have issued a statement to the world, wholly and solely as a result of the plea of the British Labour leader, he, the General Secretary, was standing all Soviet forces back to green status. Mr. Kinnock would have landed in London with the stature of global statesman. The day before polling, he would have made a resounding speech to the British nation on the issue of a final renunciation of the nuclear madness once and for all. It was calculated in Plan Aurora that the events of the previous 6 days would have shattered the traditional alliance with America, isolated the USA from all European sympathy, and swung 10%, the vital 10% of the British electorate, to vote Labour into office. After that, the hard left would have taken over. And that, General, was Plan Aurora. Karpov rose. You have been very kind, Professor, and very wise. Remain silent, and I shall also. As you say, it's all archival now, and your son's file will remain in my safe for a very long time. Goodbye. I do not think I shall be troubling you again. He leaned back against the cushions as the Chaika swept him away down Komsomolsky Prospekt. Oh, yes, it's brilliant, he thought. But is there time? Like the General Secretary, he too knew of the forthcoming election in Britain, slated for that June, 60 days away. The information to the General Secretary had, after all, come through his residentura in their London embassy. He ran the plan over and over in his mind, seeking the flaws. It's good, he thought at last, damn good. Just so long as it works. The alternative would be catastrophic. An initiator, my dear man, is a sort of detonator for a bomb, said Dr. Wynne Evans. Oh, said Preston. He felt somewhat deflated. There had been bombs before in Britain, nasty but local. He had seen quite a few in Ireland. He had heard of detonators, primers, triggers, but never an initiator. Still, it looked as if the Russian Semyonov had been carrying in a component for a terrorist group somewhere in Scotland. Which group? Tartan Army? Anarchists? Or an IRA active service unit? The Russian connection was odd, very much worth the trip to Glasgow. This initiator of polonium and lithium, would it be used in an anti-personnel bomb? He asked. Oh, yes. You could say that, Boyle, replied the Welshman. An initiator, you see, is what sets off a nuke.
Part 3, Chapter 17.
Brian Harcourt Smith listened attentively, leaning back, eyes on the ceiling, fingers toying with a slim gold-propelling pencil. "That's it?" he asked when Preston had finished his verbal report. "Yes," said Preston. "This Dr. Wynne Evans, is he prepared to put his deductions in written form?" "Hardly deductions, Brian. It's a scientific analysis of the metal, coupled with its only two known uses. And, yes, he has agreed to put it in the form of a written report. I'll attach it to my own. And your own deductions, or should I say scientific analysis?" Preston ignored the patronage. "I think it inescapable that Dekhan Semyonov had arrived in Glasgow to deposit his tin and its contents in a dead drop, or hand it over personally to someone he was due to meet," he said. "Either way, that means there is an illegal here, in on the ground. I think we could try to find him." "A charming idea. The trouble is we haven't a clue where to start. Look, John, let me be frank. You leave me, as so often, in an extremely difficult position. I really do not see how I can take this matter higher unless you can provide me with a little more evidence than a single disc of rare metal taken from a lamentably dead Russian seaman."
"It's been identified as one half of the initiator of a nuclear device," Preston pointed out. "It's hardly just a bit of metal."
"Very well. One half of what might be the trigger of what might be a device, which might have been destined for a Soviet illegal who might be resident in Britain. Believe me, John, when you submit me your full report, I shall, as ever, consider it with the greatest gravity."
"And then NFA it?" asked Preston. Harcourt Smith's smile was unfaltering and dangerous.
"Not necessarily. Any report from you will be treated on its merits like anyone else's. Now, I suggest you try to find for me at least some corroborative evidence to support your evident predilection for the conspiracy theory. Make that your next priority."
"All right," said Preston as he rose. "I'll get stuck into it."
"You do that," said Harcourt Smith.
When Preston had gone, the Deputy Director General consulted a list of in-house numbers and called the head of personnel.
On the following day, Wednesday the 15th, a British Airways flight from Paris touched down about noon at Birmingham Airport. Among the passengers was a young man with a Danish passport. The name on the passport was also Danish, and had anyone been so curious as to address him in Danish, he would have responded fluently. He had, in fact, had a Danish mother, from whom he had learned his basic grasp of the language, now honed to perfection in several language schools and on visits to Denmark. His father had, however, been a German, and the young man, born well after the Second World War, originated from Erfurt, where he had been raised. That made him an East German. He also happened to be a staff officer in the East German HVA intelligence service. He had no idea of the significance of his mission in Britain, nor did he care to find out. His instructions were simple, and he followed them to the letter. Passing without difficulty through customs and immigration, he hailed a cab and asked to be taken to the Midland Hotel in New Street. Throughout the journey, and during the check-in procedures, he was careful to favour his left arm, which was encased in a plaster cast. He had been warned, if warning was necessary, under no circumstances to attempt to pick up his grip with the broken arm. Once in his room, he locked the door and went to work on the plaster cast with the tough steel cutters tucked at the bottom of his sponge bag, carefully snipping down the inside of the forearm along the line of tiny indentations that marked the cutting path. When the cut was complete, he prized the cast open half an inch and withdrew his arm, wrist, and hand. The empty cast he dropped into the plastic carrier bag he had brought with him. He spent the entire afternoon in his room, so that the day staff at reception should not see him with the cast off, and only left the hotel late at night when a different staff was on duty. The newspaper kiosk at New Street Station was where they had said it would be, and at the appointed hour a figure in black leather motorcycle clothing approached him. The muttered exchange of identification took seconds. The plastic bag changed hands, and the figure in leather was gone. Neither of them had attracted a passing glance. At the hour of dawn, when the night staff at the hotel were still on duty, the Dane checked out, took the early train to Manchester, and flew out from that airport, where no one had ever seen him before, with or without a plaster cast. By sundown, via Hamburg, he was back in Berlin, where he went through the wall as a Dane at Checkpoint Charlie. His own people met him on the other side, heard his report, and spirited him away. Courier 3 had delivered. John Preston was annoyed and not in the best of humours. The week he had arranged to take off work to be with Tommy was being ruined. Tuesday had been partly taken up with his verbal report to Harcourt Smith, and Tommy had had to spend the day reading or watching the television. Preston had insisted on keeping their date to go to Madame Tussaud's waxwork museum that Wednesday morning, but had come into the office in the afternoon to finish his written report. The letter from Crichton and personnel was on his desk. He read it with something close to disbelief. It was couched, as ever, in the friendliest terms. A glance at the files had shown that Preston was owed 4 weeks' leave. He would be, of course, aware of the rules of the service. Backlogging of leave was not encouraged for obvious reasons. Necessity to keep all leave-taking up to date, blah, blah, blah. In short, he would be required to take up his backlog of leave forthwith, i.e. as of the following morning. "Bloody idiots," he called to the office in general. "Some of them couldn't find their way to the can without a Labrador." He called personnel, insisted on speaking to Crichton personally. "Tim, it's me, John Preston. Look, what's this letter doing on my desk? I can't take leave now. I'm on a case, right in the middle of it. Yes, I know it's important not to backlog leave, but this case is also important. A damn sight more so, actually." He heard out the bureaucrat's explanation concerning the disruption caused to the system if staffers backlog too much leave, then cut in. "Look, Tim, let's keep it short. All you have to do is call Brian Harcourt Smith. He'll vouch for the importance of the case I'm on. I can take the leave in the summer." "John," said Tim Crichton gently, "that letter was written at the express orders of Brian." Preston stared at the handset for several moments. "I see," he said finally, and put it down. "Where are you going?" asked Bright as he headed for the door. "To get a stiff drink," said Preston. It was well after lunch, and the bar was almost empty. The late lunch crowd had not yet been replaced by the early evening thirst quenchers. There was a couple over from Charles Street having a head-to-head in one corner, so he took a stool at the bar itself. He wanted to be alone. "Whiskey," he said. "Large one." "Same for me," said a voice at his elbow. "And it's my round." He turned to see Barry Banks from K7. "Hello, John," said Banks. "Saw you scouting down here as I was crossing the lobby." "Just wanted to say I have something for you. The master was most grateful." "Oh, yes, that. Not at all." "I'll bring it to your office tomorrow," said Banks. "Don't bother," said Preston angrily. "We're down here to celebrate my 4 weeks' leave as of tomorrow. Enforced. Cheers." "Don't knock it," said Banks gently. "Most people can't wait to get away from the place." He had already noticed Preston was nursing a grudge of some kind, and intended to ease the reason for it from his MI5 colleague. What he was not able to tell Preston was that he had been asked by Sir Nigel Irvine to cultivate the black sheep of Mr. Harcourt Smith's books, and to report back on what he learned. An hour and 3 whiskies later, Preston was still sunk in gloom. "I'm thinking of quitting," he said suddenly. Banks, a good listener who only interjected to extract information, was concerned. "Pretty drastic," he said. "Nothing's that bad." "Look, Barry, I don't mind free-falling from 20,000 feet. I don't mind people taking pot-shots at me when the chute opens, but I get bloody annoyed when the flak's coming from my own side. Is that unreasonable?"
"Sounds perfectly justified to me," said Banks. "So who's shooting?"
"Whiz kid upstairs," growled Preston. "Just put in another report he didn't seem to like."
"NFA'd again?" Preston shrugged.
"It will be."
The door opened to admit a crowd from upstairs. Brian Harcourt Smith was at the centre of it, several of his heads of section around him. Preston drained his glass. "Well, I must love you and leave you. Taking my boy to the pictures tonight." When he had gone, Barry Banks finished his drink, avoided an invitation to join the group at the bar, and went to his office. From there, he made a long phone call to C in his office in Sentinel House. It was not until the small hours of the Thursday that Major Piotrowski arrived back at Cherry Hayes Close. The black leathers and visored mask were with the BMW in their garage at Thetford. When he drove his little Ford quietly onto the hard pad in front of his garage and let himself into the house, he was in a sober suit and light raincoat. No one noticed him, or the plastic carrier bag in his hand. With the door firmly locked behind him, he went upstairs and pulled open the bottom drawer of the clothes chest. Inside was a Sony transistor radio. Beside it, he laid the empty plaster cast. He did not interfere with either item. He did not know what they contained, nor did he wish to find out. That would be for the assembler, who would not arrive to perform his task until the complete list of required components had been safely received. Before sleeping, he made himself a cup of tea. There were 9 couriers in all. That meant 9 first rendezvous and 9 backups in case of a no-show at the first. He had memorized them all, plus another 6, which represented the 3 extra couriers to be used as replacements if necessary. One of those would now have to be called on, as courier 2 had failed to show. Piotrowski had no idea why that courier had failed. Far away in Moscow, Major Volkov knew. Moscow had had a complete report from the Glasgow consul, who had assured his government that the dead seaman's effects were locked up in Partick police station and would remain there until further notice. Piotrowski checked his mental list. Courier 4 was due in 4 days, and the meet was in the West End of London. It was dawn of the 16th when he slept. As he drifted off, he could hear the whine of a milk float entering the close, and the clatter of the day's first deliveries. This time, Banks was more open. He was waiting for Preston in the lobby of his own apartment block when the MI5 man drove up on the Friday afternoon with Tommy in the passenger seat. The pair of them had been at the Hendon Aircraft Museum, where the boy, enthused by the fighter planes of bygone ages, had announced he intended to be a pilot when he grew up. His father knew he had decided on at least 6 careers in the past and would change his mind again before the year was out. It had been a good afternoon. Banks seemed surprised to see the boy. He had evidently not expected his presence. He nodded and smiled, and Preston introduced him as someone from the office. "What is it this time?" asked Preston.
"A colleague of mine wants another word with you," said Banks carefully.
"Monday do?" asked Preston. On Sunday, his week with Tommy would be over, and he would drive the boy to Mayfair to hand him over to Julia.
"Actually, he's waiting for you now."
"Back seat of a car again?" asked Preston.
No, a small flat we keep in Chelsea."
Preston sighed. "Give me the address. I'll go while you take Tommy for an ice cream up the road."
"I'll have to check," said Banks.
He went into a nearby phone booth and made a call. Preston and his son waited on the pavement. Banks came back and nodded.
"It's all right," he said, and gave Preston a piece of paper.
Preston drove off while Tommy showed Banks the directions of his favourite ice cream parlour. The flat was small and discreet in a modern block off Chelsea Manor Street. Sir Nigel answered the door himself. He was, as usual, full of old-world courtesy.
"My dear John, how good of you to come."
If someone had been brought to his presence trussed like a chicken and borne by 4 heavies, he would still have said, "How good of you to come." When they were seated in the small sitting room, the master held out the original Preston report.
"My sincere thanks. Extremely interesting.
But not apparently believable." Sir Nigel glanced at the younger man sharply, but chose his words with care.
"I would not necessarily agree with that."
Then he smiled quickly and changed the subject. "Now, please don't think ill of Barry, but I asked him to keep an eye on you. It appears you're not too happy in your work at present."
"Not in work at present, sir. I'm on compulsory leave."
"So I gather. Something that happened in Glasgow, was it?"
"You have not yet received a report on the Glasgow incident of last week?
It concerned a Russian seaman, a man I believe to be a courier. Surely that involves 6.
"Doubtless it will be on its way before long," said Sir Nigel carefully. "Would you be kind enough to tell me about it?"
Preston started at the beginning and told the tale through to the end, so far as he knew it. Sir Nigel sat as if lost in thought, which he was, taking in every word with part of his mind and calculating with the rest. They would not really try it, would they? He was thinking, not breach the fourth protocol. Or would they? Desperate men sometimes take desperate measures, and he had several reasons to know that in a number of areas, food production, the economy, and Afghanistan, the USSR was in desperate waters. He noted that Preston had stopped talking. "Do forgive me," he said. "What do you deduce from it all?" "I believe Semyonov was not a merchant navy deckhand, but a courier. That seems to me unavoidable. I do not believe he would have gone to those lengths to protect what he was carrying, or end his life to avoid what he must have thought was interrogation by us, unless he had been instructed his mission was of crucial importance." "Fair enough," conceded Sir Nigel. "And so?" "And so I believe there was an intended recipient of that disk of polonium, either directly through a rendezvous or by a dead drop. That means he's here, on the ground. I think we should try to find him." Sir Nigel pursed his lips. "If he's a top illegal, finding him would be a needle in a haystack affair," he murmured. "Yes, I know that. So, if you had not been sent on compulsory leave, what would you have sought authority to do?" "I think, Sir Nigel, that one disk of polonium is no use to anybody. Whatever the illegal is up to, there must be other components. Now, it seems whoever mounted the Semyonov incursion has taken a policy decision not to use the Soviet embassy diplomatic bag. I don't know why, but it would have been much easier to ship a small, lead-lined package into Britain in the embassy bag and have one of their Line N people leave it at a dead drop for collection by the man on the ground. So, I ask myself why they didn't do just that. And the short answer is, I don't know." "Right," conceded Sir Nigel. So, if there has been one consignment, useless in itself, there must be others. Some may have already arrived. On the law of averages, there must be more yet to come, and apparently they are coming in via mules or couriers who pose as harmless seamen or God knows what else besides." "And you want to do what?" asked Sir Nigel. Preston took a deep breath. "I would have wanted," he stressed the conditional aspect, "to check back on all entrants from the Soviet Union over the past 40, 50, even 100 days. One could not count on another mugging by hooligans, but there might have been some other incident. If not, I would want to tighten up controls on all entrants from the USSR and even from the whole sub-bloc to see if we could intercept another component. As head of C5C, I could have done that." "And you think now that you won't get the chance?" Preston shook his head. "Even if I was allowed back to work tomorrow, I'm pretty certain I would be off the case. Apparently I'm an alarmist, and I make waves." Sir Nigel nodded pensively. "Poaching between the services is not regarded as terribly good form," he said, as if thinking aloud. "When I asked you to go down to South Africa for me, it was Sir Bernard who sanctioned it. Later I learned the attachment, however temporary, had caused, how shall I put it, some hostility in certain quarters at Charles Street. Now, I don't need an open quarrel with my sister's service. On the other hand, I take a view, shared by yourself, that there might be more to this iceberg than the tip. In short, you have 3 weeks' leave. Would you be prepared to spend them working on this case?" "For whom?" asked Preston, bewildered. "For me," said Sir Nigel. "You couldn't come to Sentinel. You'd be seen. Word would get around." "Then work from where?" "Here," said C. "It's small, but it's comfortable. I have the authority to ask for exactly the same information as you, if you are at your desk. Any incident involving a Soviet or sub-bloc arrival will have to be recorded, either on paper or in a computer. Since you cannot be brought to the files or the computer, I can arrange for the files and the printout to be brought to you. What do you say?" "If Charles Street finds out, I'm finished with five," said Preston. He was thinking of his salary, of his pension, of the chances of getting another job at his age, of Tommy. "How much longer do you think you've got at Charles under its present management?" asked Sir Nigel. Preston laughed shortly. "Not long," he said. "All right, sir, I'll do it. I want to stay on this case. There's something buried in there somewhere."
Sir Nigel nodded approvingly. "You're a tenacious man, John. I like tenacity. It usually yields results. Be here on Monday at 9. I'll have two of my own lads waiting for you. Ask them for what you want, and they'll get it." On the Monday morning, as Preston started work on the Chelsea flat, an internationally famous Czech concert pianist arrived at Heathrow Airport from Prague, en route to his Wigmore Hall concert the following evening. The airport authorities had been alerted, and in deference to his venerability, customs and immigration formalities were as little onerous as possible. The old musician was met after the customs hall by a representative of the Victor Hochhauser organization, and with his small retinue whisked off to his suite at the Cumberland Hotel. His retinue consisted of three: his dresser, who looked after his clothes and his other personal effects with dedicated devotion, a female secretary, who handled his fan mail and correspondence, and his personal aide, a tall, lugubrious man called Lichka, who took care of negotiations with host organizations and finances, and seemed to live on a diet of antacid tablets. That Monday, Mr. Lichka was working his way through an abnormally large amount of his pills. He had not wanted to do what was required of him, but the men from the STB had been extremely persuasive. No one in their right mind deliberately affronted the men of the STB, Czechoslovakia's secret police and intelligence organization, or wished to be invited for further discussions at their headquarters, the dreaded monastery. The men had made plain his granddaughter's entry into university would be so much easier to arrange if he was prepared to help them, a polite way of saying that the girl did not stand a chance of entering university if he failed them. When they had given him his shoes back, he could find no trace of interference, and according to instructions had worn them on the flight and straight through Heathrow Airport. That evening a man walked up to the reception desk and politely asked the number of Mr. Lichka's room. Equally politely he was given it. 5 minutes later, at the precise hour he had been briefed to expect, there was a soft knock on Lichka's door. A piece of paper was pushed under it. He checked the identification code, opened the door 5 inches, and passed out a plastic bag containing his pair of shoes. Unseen hands took the bag, and he closed the door. When he had flushed the scrap of paper down the toilet pan, he sighed with relief. It had been easier than he had expected. Now, he thought, we can get on with the business of playing music. Before midnight, in a backwater of Ipswich, the shoes joined the plaster cast and the radio in the bottom drawer. Courier 4 had delivered. Sir Nigel Irvine visited Preston at the Chelsea apartment on the Friday afternoon. The MI5 man was looking exhausted, and the flat was awash with files and computer printout paper. He had spent 5 days and had come up with nothing. He started with every entry into Britain from the USSR over the past 40 days. There had been hundreds: delegates, industrial buyers, journalists, trade union stooges, a choir group from Georgia, a dance troupe of Cossacks, 10 athletes and all their entourage, and a team of doctors for a medical conference in Manchester. And those were just the Russians. Also entering from the Soviet Union were the returning tourists, the culture vultures who had been admiring the Hermitage Museum in Leningrad, through the school party which had been singing in Kiev to the peace delegation, which had been providing a rich fodder for the Soviet propaganda machine by condemning its own country in press conferences in Moscow and Kharkov. Even that list did not include the Aeroflot crews, who had been shuttling in and out as part of the normal air traffic, so First Officer Romanov hardly rated a mention. There was, of course, no reference to a Dane coming into Birmingham from Paris and leaving through Manchester. By the Wednesday, Preston had had two options: stay with the ex-USSR entrants, but go back 60 days, or widen the net to take in all entrants from any sub-bloc country. That meant thousands and thousands of arrivals. He had decided to stay with his 40-day timescale, but to include the non-Soviet communist states. The paperwork began to get waist-high. Customs had been most helpful. There had been some confiscations, but always for an excess of the duty-free allowance. Nothing of inexplicable character had been confiscated. Immigration had come up with no bent passports, but that was to be expected. The weird and wonderful bits of paperwork sometimes proffered at passport control by people from the Third World were never produced by people from the Communist World. Not even time-expired passports, the usual reason for an immigration officer stopping a visitor from entry. In communist countries, the departing traveller's passport was so thoroughly checked before departure that there was little chance of a stop at the British end.
"That," said Preston gloomily, "still leaves the uncheckables, the other merchant seamen entering without controls at over 20 commercial ports, the crews off the fishing factory ships now riding off Scotland, the commercial air crews who are hardly checked at all, and those with diplomatic cover."
"As I thought," said Sir Nigel. "Not easy. Have you any idea what you're looking for?"
"Yes, sir. I had one of your lads spend Monday out at Aldermaston with the people in nuclear engineering. It seems that disc of polonium would be suitable for a device at once small, crude, basic in design, and not very powerful. If one can describe any atomic bomb as not very powerful."
He handed Sir Nigel a list of items. "These are, at a guess, something like what we're looking for." C studied the list of artifacts.
"Is that all it takes?" he asked at length.
"In kit form, apparently yes. I'd no idea they could be made so basic.
Apart from the fissionable core and the steel tamper, that stuff could be hidden almost anywhere and excite no attention."
"All right, John. Where do you go now?"
"I'm looking for a pattern, Sir Nigel. It's all I can look for. A pattern of entries and exits by the same passport number. If one or two couriers are being used, they would have to come in and out frequently, using different entry and exit points, probably different departure points abroad. But if a pattern shows up, we could put out an all-nation alert for a limited group of passport numbers. It's not much, but it's all I have."
Sir Nigel rose. "Keep at it, John. I'll get you access to anything you ask for.
Let's just pray whoever we are dealing with slips up, just once, by using the same courier twice or three times."
But Major Volkov was better than that. He did not slip up. He had no idea what the components were, nor what they were for. He simply knew he had been ordered to ensure their entry into Britain in time for a series of rendezvous inside the island, that each courier would have memorized his primary and backup rendezvous, and that nothing was to pass through the KGB residentura in the London embassy. He had 9 cargoes to infiltrate, and 12 prepared couriers. Some, he knew, were not professionals, but where their cover was impeccable and their journey arranged weeks or months earlier, as in the case of Lichka, the Czech, he had honed in on them. In order not to alert Major General Borisov by stripping him of a further 12 illegals and their legends, he had cast his net wider than the USSR by calling on 3 of the sister services, the STB of Czechoslovakia, the SB service of Poland, and most of all the obedient and unquestioning Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung, HVA, of East Germany. The East Germans were particularly good. While there are Polish and Czech communities in West Germany, France, and Britain, the East Germans had one great advantage. Because of the ethnic identity of East Germans and West Germans, and the fact that millions of former East Germans had already fled to West Germany, the HVA from their East Berlin base ran by far the greater number of in-place illegals in the West than any other East Bloc service. Volkov had decided to use only 2 Russians, and they would be the first to go in. He had no way of knowing one would be mugged by street thugs, nor was he aware the 4th seaman's consignment was no longer locked up in a Glasgow police station. He just took treble precautions because that was his nature and his training. For his remaining 7 cargoes, he was using 1 courier supplied by the Poles, 2 by the Czechs, including Lichka, and 4 by the East Germans. The 10th courier, replacing the dead courier 2, would also come from the Poles. For the structural alterations that he needed to make to 2 motor vehicles, he was even using a garage and workshop run by the HVA in Brunswick, West Germany. Only the 2 Russians and the Czech Lichka would have East Bloc departure points, plus now the 10th. who would have to come from the Polish airline, LOT. Volkov was simply not allowing the appearance of any of the patterns Preston now sought in his sea of paperwork in Chelsea. Sir Nigel Irvin, like so many who have to work in central London, tried to get away at the weekends for a breath of fresh air. He and Lady Irvin stayed in London during the week, but kept a small and rustic cottage in southeast Dorset, on the Isle of Purbeck, at a village called Langton Matravers. That Sunday, C had donned a tweed coat and hat, taken a thick ash stick, and walked down the lanes and tracks to the cliffs above Chapman's Pool at St. Albans Head. The sun was bright, but the wind chill. It blew the silver tushes that escaped his hat over his ears like small wings. He took the cliff path and walked, deep in thought, occasionally pausing to stare out over the tossed whitecaps of the English Channel. He was thinking of the conclusions of Preston's original report and of the remarkable concurrence of Sweeting in his Oxford reclusiveness. Coincidence? Straws in the wind? Grounds for conviction, or just a lot of nonsense from a too imaginative civil servant and a fanciful academic? And if it were all true, could there be any link with a small disc of polonium from Leningrad that had arrived uninvited in a Glasgow police station? If the metal disc was what Wynne Evans had said, what did that mean? Could it possibly mean that someone, far out over those tossing waves, was really trying to breach the fourth protocol? And if it was true, who could that someone be? Chebrikov and Kryuchkov of the KGB? They would never dare act except under the orders of the General Secretary. And if the General Secretary, why? And why not use the diplomatic bag? So much simpler, easier, safer. To the latter, he thought he could discern a reason. Using the embassy bag would mean using the KGB residentura inside the embassy. Better than Chebrikov, Kryuchkov, or the General Secretary, he knew it was penetrated. He had his source, Andreev, inside it. That made sense. The General Secretary, he suspected, had good reason to be shaken by the recent spate of defections from the KGB. All the evidence coming across was that the disillusionment at every level in Russia had become so profound it was even affecting the elite of elite. Apart from the defections, starting in the late 70s and growing through the 80s, there had been mass expulsions of Soviet diplomats across the world, caused in part by their own desperation to recruit agents, but leading to even further desperation as the diplomatic controllers were expelled and the networks left in disarray. Even Third World countries, which a decade ago danced to the Soviet tune, were now asserting themselves and expelling Soviet agents for grossly undiplomatic conduct. Yes, a major operation conducted outside the auspices of the KGB made sense. He had heard on good authority that the General Secretary personally was becoming paranoid about the level of Western penetration of the KGB itself. For every traitor who runs over, went the adage in the intelligence community, you can bet there's another one still in place. So, there's a man out there, running couriers and their cargoes into Britain, dangerous cargoes, bringing anarchy and chaos in a manner he could not yet discern, but was ceasing to doubt, even as he walked. And that man worked for another man, very high, who had no love for this small island. "But you won't find them, John," he murmured to the unheeding wind. "You're good, but they're better, and they hold the aces." Sir Nigel Irvin was one of the last of the old grandees, one of a passing breed, being replaced at every level of his society by new men of a different type. Even at the highest stratum of the civil service, where continuity of style and type was something of a household god. So he gazed out at the Channel, as so many Englishmen had done before him, and made his decision. He was not convinced of the existence of a threat to the land of his forefathers, only of the possibility of the existence of a threat.